welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are here on this podcast, as we are here every week or so, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And got a special guest today, a friend of mine, who I thought would be particularly interesting to talk to this week. His name is Sam Rocha. We have had him on the show before. Sam is an American, now living in British Columbia, up there in the People's Republic of Maplegrad. Teaching, where are you teaching at?
University of British Columbia. Just okay. Up the road.
All right.
In Vancouver.
And, well, he's just a Renaissance man. He has, he's an album out, based on the writings of St. Augustine. What would you call the music? How would you describe it?
I call it Augustinian soul music.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, he's also got a new book out, and he's up there. You're teaching, which department do you teach in?
So I'm a philosopher teaching in a faculty of education.
Okay.
So I teach, my subfield is actually called philosophy of education. So
okay. All right.
My department's called educational studies.
And, lifelong Catholic.
Yep.
And, what is also, important here because of what we're going to be talking about today, your background is Mexican, right?
Yeah, that's right. Mexican American, that's right. Yeah,
Mexican American Catholic.
Or if you want to be very exact, you can say Texican.
Texican. Okay. We're actually speaking to you. You're in Texas right now, right?
I'm back in the Republic of Texas for a family wedding. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you basically snuck across the border then, right? I mean,
that's right. That's
yeah,
right.
Like yeah. good Mexicans do. And yeah, and so I wanted to have Sam on the show today because of the decision by the Trump administration to rescind DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals policy that was instituted in 2012 by Obama. I want to talk a little bit about the background of that policy, talk about, you know, where did it come from, why is it here, and what is the justice or injustice, I believe, of rescinding it, and what are the potential impacts, not only on dreamers, that's the term that's used to describe, basically kids. The reason that the DACA was instituted is you have 800,000 kids who came to the United States. Some of them were brought here as babes in arms. They are Americans. I mean, they have been raised in the United States. They know no other country. This is their home. And what the DACA, policy did was basically say, we're not going to send you back to some country that you have no memory of, because of some paperwork. That's dumb. The reason that it was implemented was because Obama could not get the GOP-controlled Congress to see reason on this obvious moral question, that you don't exile people from their own country over a piece of paperwork like this. It's just insane and unjust. I mean, you know, listen, any American listening out there who's been raised in the burbs, imagine someone just walking into your home and saying, yeah, we're sending you to Venezuela. You don't speak Spanish? Oh, well. Too bad. You don't know anything about Venezuela? That's tough. You know, our paperwork says that you're going. That's what DACA is designed to prevent, and that is what the Trump administration has just repealed. Talk about this a little bit, if you could, and you know, bring your perspective to this.
Sure. I think that, I mean, I'm happy to talk about the DACA and about the DREAM Act and about their kind of legislative histories, but my sense is that my my enthusiasm about the subject matter comes from something that's a lot more intimate and personal that might maybe make more sense to people.
Mm-hmm.
I myself, you know, my family's been in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas and the area of South Texas for generations now. And my grandfather actually found out that he was an American when he was drafted for World War II. So, you know, whether we knew it or not, we've been citizens. My mother's side of the family, which is also Mexican American, mm-hmm. same story in southwestern Colorado, mm-hmm. New Mexico area. So, in my case, you know, it may seem kind of at first glance that this is a maybe I'm just reacting to this out of a kind of, you know, my own kind of perhaps nativism or ethnic pride or whatever, but and that's certainly maybe a possible account of it. But the story that really makes it meaningful is that my very first teaching assignment, I was teaching for 2 years as a visiting professor at Wabash College in Indiana, mm-hmm. just outside of Indianapolis, and I had a student who I was teaching, who was in my class, who wanted to talk to me in confidence in private. And I won't share his name now because I don't have permission to talk about
it. Of course.
Him by name. But he came to visit me and he told me the story, which is basically the story of DACA. His parents came from Mexico to the Chicago area while he was 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He attended American public school and graduated as the valedictorian of his class.
Mm-hmm.
As a valedictorian of his class, he was naturally recruited very highly by a number of especially local Chicago, Indiana, Midwestern colleges and universities. Because he wasn't able to apply for Pell Grant funding or any kind of federal student loans or anything like that, it only made any practical sense for him that if he was going to be able to attend college, that he attend a private institution that was able to offer him a private academic support package. And this private institution that offered him a full ride on a very competitive 4-year scholarship was Wabash College. So he attended as one of our best and brightest, mm-hmm. on the basis of his academic record. Now, whenever he arrived, his dream was to become a teacher because of the transformative effects that the schooling system had on his life. Yet whenever it came time to think about things like practicum, where in order to enter a school, you need a background check, and in order to have a background check, you need to, you know, submit some basic documentation, including a social security card, it became clear that he was going to be unable to become a teacher through that program.
Mm-hmm.
And it became obvious to him that he also couldn't study law for similar reasons and things like this. So he came to me with the simple practical fact that I would have liked to be a teacher, but I don't think I can. What can I do? Do I need to go back to Mexico? If I do, I won't see my parents for between 4 and 8 years or my brothers and sisters. Should I really do that? I mean, we had a very practical, real conversation. This wasn't a political rally or anything like that. And this happened in 2010.
Mm.
And this is when I became aware of the situation that DACA was proposed to address, which is that, by the way, his brothers, who were very good at soccer, they weren't exactly the greatest students, were offered major soccer scholarships to state universities, which they simply couldn't take because of their situation. And because of that, they never went to college at all.
Mm-hmm.
And his brothers also arrived as children. So this, for people who aren't familiar with the intimate details, and I became aware, by the way, that because of Wabash's unique position, especially in relationship to the Chicago area, that we had, you know, a handful of these students who were, again, our best and brightest, but they were living as a class apart. They were living as students who didn't have access to the professions that the other students at the college had access to. We had students who were living ostensibly in a very real policy-based fear for themselves, for their families, for their siblings, all these things. I was a Gates scholar when I went through college. One of my students joked to me about how, like, I'm pretty sure I could have been a Gates scholar too. I just wasn't Pell Grant eligible because they weren't able to apply. And I joked and I said, I think you're right. So this is where I became aware of the issue. It became real to me as a professor, mm-hmm. as a teacher. And this affects people's lives in tremendous ways. And so whenever DACA was proposed by Obama, it was frankly the result of the fact that both the Democratic and Republican Congress, since really the Bush era, Bush 2, were unable to pass what's now referred to as the DREAM Act, but basically comprehensive immigration reform.
Yeah.
And a lot of this happened because there was a time in the Reagan era, if people want to talk about amnesty, the last person to give a full comprehensive immigration reform amnesty was Ronald Reagan.
That liberal communist.
Yeah, exactly. That guy. after the sexual revolution, Reagan came in and laid down the last, blow with amnesty.
Mm-hmm.
But, it used to be that the Republican Party, actually, the grand old party, was the party that saw questions of immigration as a part of their family values message. And it was crazy.
Which it should be.
In theory. Absolutely. In theory.
Yeah.
Something
a friend of mine pointed out was, 10 years ago, we were hearing, as a result of the freak out after 9/11, one of the things that you heard from the pro-life family values, right, was demographic winter. We're facing demographic winter, Sam. Mm-hmm. The Muslims are outbreeding us because mm-hmm. we are contracepting ourselves out of existence. And mm-hmm. so we have to start, we have to get busy, if you catch my meaning, if you get my drift. And we need to, shore up our good Christian numbers because the Muslims are just going to take over. That was one of the things you heard. And so, look, here's 20 million Christians who are in our country. And as that became clear, it also became extremely clear that the issue wasn't really about Christians.
That's right.
It was about brown people. And so we don't want brown Christians, because something terrible will happen.
I actually think that there is maybe a slightly even, ironically in this case, darker story to that, because if you look back to, for instance, the potato famine in the 19th century that brought so many Irish Catholics to our nation's shores through Ellis Island.
Yeah.
I don't know if a lot of people know this, but the term wetback, which is a slur, I can use it because of my proximity to the term. Uh-huh. But that term refers to someone who has swam their way to shore and who needs to then immediately flee so they can dry themselves off, but they can't quite dry off their back. An immigrant who's done that. A lot of people, of course, today, for good reason, assume it's someone who's just had a dip in the Rio Grande River.
Right.
Which makes sense. But the first wetbacks were actually people were Irishmen who were stowaways on ships who didn't want to be put through the Ellis Island procedure. So when they saw land, they would jump and they would swim to New York or Long Island.
Oh, okay. I know that.
Yeah, yeah. And the reason I bring this up, though, is that there's always been an attitude in our country historically, wave after wave, that I think goes a little bit beyond the skin level. And it gets into the fact that the Whig Party, which split and became Reagan, Lincoln's party because of the nativist fringe that emerged to oppose the abolitionists at the start of the Civil War. The Whig Party was appalled at the influx of not necessarily brown Irish, but of Catholic Irishmen. And if you look at our history's treatment of Italians afterwards and of Poles and of, and at every turn, I think that there's a deep anti-Catholicism rooted in the kind of Protestant identity of our nation that is at least in part and in addition explanatory of the attitudes and the hostilities to the.
Yes. And it was something, by the way, that the Irish got. When they came here, one of the unknown chapters in American history to most Americans is the existence of what was known as the San Patricio Brigade. And it was a bunch of Irishmen who went down to fight for the Mexicans against white Protestants in Texas because they felt more commonality with Catholic Mexicans than they did with Protestant whites in this country. And that's, most people don't know that story, but, you know, you know, there is a long, it's been famously called by Arthur Schlesinger Jr., anti-Catholicism has been famously called the last acceptable prejudice in the United States.
Sure.
And so, yeah, you're right there.
Well, maybe not anymore. We've kind of, acceptable prejudice has kind of been in vogue these days. So
yes,
I'm sorry,
no kidding.
All my Jewish brothers and sisters, and all my African American brothers and sisters. Yeah.
But yeah, I think you're right. And I speaking of, you know, while we're talking about American history a little bit, one of the things that has troubled me. I was watching a there's a really, really great 9-part documentary on the Civil War that was done back in 1989 by Ken Burns. And one of the things that it discusses is the fact that in 1864, the United States attempted something that had never been done in the history of the world, holding free elections during a Civil War. Never been attempted.
Yeah.
And it really, Lincoln assumed that he was not going to be reelected. And there was a strong peace party. By 1864, the U.S. was just utterly sick of war, for all kinds of understandable reasons.
Sure.
It was a gruesome, murderous war that killed more Americans. Robert E. Lee is responsible for the death of more Americans than Adolf Hitler. Most people don't know that, you know.
Yeah, people don't quite realize the casualties from the Civil War. Of America. They outgained both of the World Wars, the Korean Wars, the Vietnam War, and I believe, the Iraq Wars combined.
Yeah, it was a massive bloodbath.
Yeah.
And so by 1864, everybody, North and South, was utterly sick of the war. When the election was held, then, of course, the election became a referendum on the war. And there'd been nothing but bad news all through 1864. And one of the things that had happened right at the beginning of 1863, for which Lincoln, of course, is now hailed as a hero, was the Emancipation Proclamation. He did it as a military measure. We say Lincoln freed the slaves. What the Emancipation Proclamation, and eventually that's true when we passed the 13th Amendment. But, sure. But what the Emancipation Proclamation was designed to do was deprive the South of materiel for the war. That was the rationale for the Emancipation Proclamation. Slaves were property, and that property is being used in the war effort. Let's see what we can do to deprive the South of property useful in the war effort. And that's what the Emancipation Proclamation was really about. Yeah. And that's how it was sold, if you will. But the inevitable effect of the Emancipation Proclamation was to make the war not merely about the restoration of the Union, but about the abolition of slavery. it had, the South had entered into the war, for one reason, to preserve the institution of slavery. I mean, that's what states, when you hear, well, it was about states' rights, what it meant was the right of the
states' state right to have slaves.
To preserve slavery. You know, yeah, that's, exactly. That's what it was about, you know. And so there was a back and forth in the North, for a while about using black soldiers. Initially, blacks were turned away, from attempts to sign up, as Union soldiers. But eventually, the North realized that's dumb. And, eventually there were, I think it was 100,000 black troops. I forget the exact number.
Yeah.
But by 1864, not everybody in the North was an abolitionist. And most people in the North, had just as much, the opinion that blacks were inferior to whites as everybody in the South did.
That's right.
And, so by 1864, a lot of Northerners were saying, why do I have to go die in this meat grinder war to free inferior black slaves? I don't care about these people. And in fact, members of Lincoln's own party came to him and said, you should think about rescinding the Emancipation Proclamation, and when black troops have finished their term of service, you should just remand them to slavery again. And Lincoln's response, Lincoln was by no means anything like an Orthodox Christian. His theological views are unique. But Lincoln said famously, I would be damned in time and eternity if I should return these black warriors to slavery after they have served their country. I mention all of that because we have, as a nation, we have deported veterans who are missing a piece of paperwork. We have deported people who have put their bodies in harm's way for us. And we are now talking about deporting dreamers who put their bodies in harm's way for victims of Hurricane Harvey.
Yeah.
And I look at that and I think, do we not fear God that we would do that, that we would do something that despicable? We have already done it to vets who happen to be missing some paperwork that would make them a citizen. The pagan Romans got this. Pagan Romans would grant citizenship to, non-citizens, barbarians and so forth, who came and served in the legions. It was the least you could do.
Yeah. What I really like about that, Mark, is that, it's tedious and it's not exactly it's not bumper sticker material, but, I think one of the more dangerous, aspects of the present situation is, because on the one hand, I frankly do believe that Trump is kind of a completely new political phenomenon in American history.
Yeah.
That being said, though, his playbook and the issues we're facing are by no means new ones. And I think that sometimes there's a kind of a forgetfulness of the fact that in many cases, well, first of all, at a philosophical level, injustice is injustice is injustice is injustice.
Yeah,
and in our nation, whether it's the legacy of the slave trade and slavery, or any other number of things, the Jim Crow South, the separate but equal clauses in the Southwest and in Texas against Mexican Americans, or the few people know that in the 1930s there was actually another nativist stream that actually took American citizen Latinos and deported them.
Are you kidding me?
No, this actually happened. It was called a repatriation
of citizens.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. And so this whole thing has happened. It happened between 1929 and 1936. In 2005, in fact, the state of California passed an apology act for the 1930s Mexican repatriation program.
Okay.
So, you know, as bad as the times are now, this evil is not simply something to be repaired in the immediate present. This evil is something that has existed in the DNA of the historical legacy of our country for generations.
Yeah.
And so whenever people look at things like, why are so many people upset about Nazis and trying to save a Confederate history? Why are people so upset over, you know, instances of police brutality against, you know, African Americans? So, you know, what's the big deal here? I can understand at some level that if someone has a particular historical lens on, they would find these things ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But for certain people, they just repair that lens by like reading books and stuff like that, you know? But for a lot of people, like, you know, in my case, me, we carry these stories kind of, you know, in a, you might say, ontological way. We carry them on our bodies in a way, you know? And I think that this is what people don't realize, that Trump, if he wanted to fix DACA, which was an executive order, he could have addressed Congress and said, I want you to pass comprehensive immigration reform to replace the executive order we have holding over this. He could have done that.
Yes.
He could have led the charge for that. And you know what? I would have lauded him for that.
Me too.
Believe it or not, whenever Trump was going to run the first time around, I believe in 2012, there was a bit of this pony racing in the primaries. And there was actually a moment in which Newt Gingrich kind of disqualified himself from the race because he said that he was unwilling to separate families in immigration procedures. And Gingrich basically was laughed off the stage and never recovered in that primary. Gingrich and I don't traditionally share politics, but I was the first person to say that had he made it through, I might have pulled a ballot for him.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Trump could have done this in a way, but what he did instead is he pardoned the sheriff out in Arizona who's guilty of horrendous crimes against immigrants. And then just over a week later.
Just to be clear, in case the listener doesn't know what you're talking about.
Sure.
We're talking about Sheriff Joe Arpaio.
Yeah.
Who was out in Maricopa County, in Arizona, and who ran a torture chamber. It's unbelievable the stuff that guy got away with. He was eventually convicted on it's sort of like Al Capone going to jail for tax evasion, you know? It's like, well, okay, that was a thing he did, but. the kinds of outrages that he committed, you know, neglect of pregnant women so that they lost their children. He was interning people in what he described as concentration camps in 125 degree heat where the soles of their shoes were melting. Beatings, he neglected children who were being subjected to rape, multiple times. Just an absolute horror show. And Trump pardoned him. And why did he do it? Because he knew that it would be popular with his alt-right racist base. And that's why he did it.
And in the wake of him taking criticism, for his response to the Virginia situation. So, you know, I mean, the guy is on skates. But let me also emphasize that one of the things that the sheriff was doing is that he was basically targeting people just based on how they looked. The Mexican repatriation movement I mentioned, which, by the way, repatriated between 500,000 and 2 million people, of whom not all of them, but 60% or more were U.S. born citizens.
Mm-hmm.
They were targeted based on just how they looked.
Right.
Right. So again, the historical precedent for this stuff is crazy. But after this, Trump says he's, you know, gonna in 6 months put down DACA, and this is gonna force Congress to act. And he makes it sound right now, the news spin is that this is actually a smart move. It's gonna force Congress to do something for once, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be fooled. Congress, which by the way deserves a lot of blame. And by the way, on this, I have no sympathy for Obama whatsoever. Obama deported more people than Bush did before him or Clinton did before
yes,
him.
Yes, he
Bush
did.
Before him.
And that's
Obama
really important. It's really important to emphasize that, you know, because one of the things you always hear is, you're just, you know, you hate Trump and you're defending Obama. Obama
was a disaster.
He was a catastrophe for immigrants.
Oh, yeah. And he ran, by the way, on a platform that kind of had this very loose sense that don't worry, if we get elected, we're gonna finally get the Dream Act in place. You know, Bush got a lot closer, by the way, to passing comprehensive immigration reform than Obama ever did.
Mm-hmm.
And Bush did against it, pushing against his own party in mm-hmm. that case.
Yeah.
All that to say, though, is that, you know, the things about DACA today as it's some kind of a legislative, you know, make this a legal policy or what have you, that could be done in an entirely different way than the sequence is now.
Mm.
But I would also encourage your listeners to realize that the situation with Dreamers and DACA is not the same as the general questions of immigration. We could have different kinds of arguments about immigrants writ large or refugees, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
But when we're talking about people who have been raised in this country for all of their conscious will-given lives, being sent to a country that is as foreign to them as it would be to any of us,
right,
who are not as foreign as Canada is to me right now as an immigrant myself.
Yeah.
And believe me, by the way, it kind of is. But that's another story. This is something that I don't think takes.
At least they've got Jersey milk bars there, you know. I mean,
that is true.
There is that.
Yeah. But there's the CFL, and that's a problem. at any rate, you know, this shouldn't be a high bar. I think, though, that for some of your listeners, though, they might struggle with these kind of gotcha questions, like, well, if it's what they did is illegal, or what their parents did is illegal, so the sins of the father and all that stuff like that. You know,
which, by the way, is Bronze Age morality. I mean, this is something that the book of Ezekiel dealt with, right?
Oh, yeah.
Sins that does not make the child guilty of the father's sin. This is like a startling revelation. If you're living in 500 BC, maybe.
Exactly.
But, yeah.
No, exactly. A moral theologian or a scripture scholar should hopefully not find any of this new. For those who are looking for a less maybe theological answer, though, I mean, we don't have a single way of dealing with what illegal means. You're not punished for speeding the same way you are for murder, and you don't punish murder the same way depending on whether it's manslaughter, first, second, or third degree murder.
Right.
So I'm very open to admit that the term illegal does apply itself to those who enter the country illegally.
Right.
But the question then becomes not how do we punish them? It becomes in what sense is this illegal?
Right.
Is it illegal in the sense of a misdemeanor? Is it illegal in the sense of a felony? Is it illegal in some sense? Because to not recognize those distinctions is A, to just be operating on a logic of legality that literally doesn't apply to anyone else in the world.
Right.
And then B, it also doesn't realize that justice itself, when it's distributed, especially in a civil society, it has its nuances and it has to be accountable to the context and to what things are happening. And when it fails to do that, as Augustine teaches us, a law becomes unjust.
Right.
An unjust law is no law at all.
One of the things that I think is at the root of a Catholic instinct regarding law comes from the gospel. You know, there's the story of Jesus going through the fields with his disciples, and they start eating grain on the Sabbath.
Sure, yeah.
And the Pharisees come to him, rigid legalists. Why are they doing this on the Sabbath? This is unlawful. And Jesus' reply is, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Or, to extend the principle, the law is made for man, not man for the law. That the purpose of the law is to protect human beings who are made in the image and likeness of God. And if the rules, the Catholic instinct is, if the rules get in the way with that, then the hell with the rules.
Right.
And that's a, I think, a very important way of looking at things that is not, curiously, native to Americans. Because I had a priest one time who remarked on this. He said that the Latin conception of law is you make rules about everything and then you list all the exceptions. Anglo-Saxon conception of law, which comes out of there's something noble there, and I think it's important to point this out. The Anglo-Saxon conception of law is summarized as lex rex. The law is king. And the reason for that is noble. It's to say that just because you're the king doesn't mean you can do anything.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And that's where lex rex comes from. But the perversion of lex rex becomes, you must obey the rules no matter how stupid that is. And so he said, this explains the difference between, you know, American and Italian drivers. was my priest friend's remark. He says,
that's a really good example. Yeah.
He says, you know, American drivers will stop at a stop sign in the middle of the Mojave Desert when there is no other car around for 1,000 miles because that's the rule, right? Italians don't do that. And I thought that's a nice illustration of the distinction. And so, Cardinal George once observed that in America, everybody is a Calvinist, including all the Catholics. And by that, he meant that we Catholics have internalized a lot of American Protestant culture in ways that are not Catholic. And so, you know, we look at some vet who has put his body on the line for us in Afghanistan. A Catholic looks at that and says, just as a pagan Roman would have said, or anybody else of common sense would have said, we say, that guy, of course you don't deport that guy. Duh, right? but Lex Rex says rules are rules. It would paperwork. That is the most important thing there is.
And you know,
doesn't have the paperwork.
And you know, the difference between, because of course I live in a former Commonwealth country right now. Mm-hmm. There's also another difference between Lex Rex in the Anglo-Saxon tradition and the Commonwealth from the constitutional edition in the U.S., which is, the lex that is rex in the Commonwealth is common law. And common law is preserved through the parliamentary system. In the U.S., we codified that into a sola scriptura version of lex rex, which is the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one doesn't have to necessarily share my radical views about constitutionalism to understand this. And the Constitution certainly has its benefits in the ways that lex rex also has its benefits. But this is even more foreign to a Latin sensibility. Augustine has a similar thing to say, and Benedict XVI, whenever he was Ratzinger, actually mentions this, that for Augustine, mores, which are the basis of morals, are not rules, but they're communal ways of communal habituation. So they're the norms that emerge from the community. And this doesn't mean willy-nilly relativism. I mean, after all, Ratzinger was hardly into that. But what it means is that the communal life of the church, for instance, but the communal life of the body, constantly is, affirming and also, adapting the rules to fit its time and its place and its context.
Right.
And he actually refers to this as, regular familial discussion. He says, this is how we learn morality. We learn morality through regular familial discussion. You can't have regular familial discussion whenever you're breaking families apart.
Right.
Whenever you're literally tearing the body from limb to limb in the most arbitrary of ways possible.
Yeah.
It's moral in that exact Augustinian sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, you know, that also, you know, I've cited, you know, the extreme examples of deporting vets, and deporting other people. But that's the other thing that I watch, of course, is the spectacle of literally tearing families apart, just grabbing dad and deporting him to wherever, you know, and well, too bad. And, you know, we do this because, among other things, for some garbled reason, somehow or other, this is preventing terrorism. And as I can think of no better way to manufacture a terrorist than to take some dad, and just rip him away from his family and then tell the kids, well, tough.
Yeah.
Because paperwork, sacred, precious paperwork, is far more important, than your father ever being in your house ever again. You know, too bad for you. Yeah, if you want to make some terrorists, that's the way to do it.
And it's something that, again, I think is, you know, I don't know, Mark, but there's this deep divide between people who don't understand what it means to live in a home that you love in one sense, but that you also can't love in other senses.
Right.
And other people who see living in a home as you love the home as it is, and you shut up and you celebrate it every day, or you get out. Most people in the world can't habituate their countries or their nations or their ethnicity or their identity or whatever in that uncomplicated way. Most of us have yes and yes but sentiments. I mean, I'm back in my homeland of the, you know, like I say sometimes, you know, the Republic of Texas, and I love it in a sort of naive way.
Mm-hmm.
But if you ask me the deeper questions about it, you know, I mean, I don't know. And to me, that complexity of how we live and exist in the world goes back to that basic gospel fact that, you know, this is not our home.
Right.
And many Christians have made this their home, and they've lost the deep eschatological desire for the kingdom of God. And this is why I think the kingdom of God will belong to the humble, to the meek, to the to the refugee, to the immigrant, to the widow, to the orphan, to the alien.
I think that that's true. It's certainly a constant biblical theme. You can't read the prophets, and you cannot read Jesus, saying, you know, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who stone the prophets and kill those sent to you, how I have longed to gather you together as a hen gathers, her chicks, but you would not. Behold, your house is left to you desolate. That is the anguished cry of a patriot. And, you know, it's really vital to remember that, you know, when Jesus stands in the prophetic tradition, every one of the prophets loves their country.
Of course.
That's why they're prophets. They love their country. We're reading Jeremiah in the mass readings right now, and we're reading an anguished patriot.
Yeah.
Who is just tormented by the fact that, you know, look at everything that God has given us. Look at all that he has called us to, and look at this ridiculous, horrific way that we have responded to all the gifts that we've been given.
Yeah.
That's not, and when those patriots express their anguish like that, what they're always told, of course, by the false patriots is, you don't love your country. You're an enemy.
Yep.
I hear this all the time, you know. And you're right. You know, so the tradition, of course, does say that our true home is the heavenly Zion, and that we can never take our eyes off that fact. And Still, at the same time, it says we are bound in conscience to do everything that we can to make our earthly home the best it can be, in honor of the heavenly Zion. We have to do that. So we can't play pietistic games and go, oh well, you know, it'll all be fine eventually, and so I can feel free to ignore the alien, the orphan, and the widow. And that's, you know, that's at the heart of the Jewish prophetic tradition, and it's
yes.
absolutely at the heart of the Christian tradition as well.
Yeah.
You know, when Jesus talks about judgment, he never says we're going to be judged on our grasp of salvation by grace through faith. We're not going to be judged by, you know, our understanding of transubstantiation. What we're going to be judged by is, I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me.
Right.
That's what the judgment consists of in Christian eschatology.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that's kind of heartbreaking for a lot of us, is that, the lack of one's ability to even say that there's some real flesh and bone on the line and this is serious.
Yeah.
You know, and this is happening time and time again. And, you know, whenever Trump was, you know, talking about, grabbing women by their genitals and that he can get away with that stuff, we were told, don't take that seriously. It's not really happening. And he's just, you know, making, you know, locker room talk. And whenever he insulted mocked a disabled person, we were told that's not really what he was doing. And he just says it like it is and this and that. And,
yeah.
And at this point, we don't have time right now to go through the litany that I would have to go through. But to me, what's been so astounding, you know, like when I saw him in the debate refer to his own genitals about their size to Mark Rubio, I said, oh, that's the end. You know, we just can't. This isn't the kind of conversation America will stand for having, you know, and it's, you know, it's an elected, its highest elected, you know, primaries for its, you know, one of its two major parties. And then, you know, it did. And I think to me, it's becoming the fact that there's a deep, I think, spiritual illness that's coming upon people's hearts and consciences
yeah.
who otherwise I think are probably good and fine and decent people
yeah.
where their hatred has so consumed them for this thing called the left or liberals or Obama or maybe even you, Mark. whatever
I have no problem you know, being on that list.
Yeah, I know. And by the way, I never got the time of day from them for other reasons, maybe. But the point is that what really scares me is this hardness of heart.
Yeah.
Because like I started off, for me, this is about some people who I can't disclose their names to you, but I can give them a phone call and ask them how they're doing. And I think for me, the issue is far more about the phone call to say, like, how are you doing? Are you scared? Can I help you?
Mm.
Don't worry. It's going to be okay. I say that to the people who are affected. I actually tell them it's going to be okay. I actually tell them this will get worked out. I actually tell them don't trouble yourself. But I tell them that in the way that you tell your child who's being threatened by an assaultant that it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
I tell them don't fret, everything's going to be fine. And the way you would tell your kid everything's going to be fine whenever you know things aren't going to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And to my brothers and sisters out there who are Christians, who are Catholics, who are people of goodwill, this is not fine
yeah.
that I have to tell people everything's going to be okay.
Yeah.
That's just, this isn't a civil or just or charitable. This is not a society.
Yeah. And the thing that breaks my heart more than anything, the thing that breaks my heart is that the biggest and loudest, and most boastfully pious supporters of all of this are people who proudly describe themselves as the real Christians,
oh, yeah.
you know, the,
oh, yeah.
and who are so ready to kick out of the church, all of us non-real Christians, including the Pope. And that's the thing that just appalls me, you know. I know perfectly well, and we're seeing, you know, I mean, one of the things that I'm really, I have been proud to see this week has been, the American bishops have really stepped up and said, you know, this is bullshit. I mean, they can't say that, but that's what they mean. Yeah. And it's the truth, you know, that you cannot do this. This is not compatible with our faith. It's just not. But, you know, as always, I mean, you know, Matt Walsh, who is just reliably wrong about just about everything, naturally, of course, came out with an article yesterday with a title that, you know, it could actually, it could have been a reasonable argument. He came out with this piece for The Blaze that basically said, you know, if you're upset about deporting children but have no problem with killing them, then be quiet. Okay, fine. You could have, you can actually make that argument. You know, you could say, look, okay, you can't support abortion, and say that you care about the life and dignity of children. Fine, make that argument. But of course, that's not what he did. Instead, what he did was he started with that line, but then immediately went to saying, well, you know, I'm in favor of deporting people.
Right.
And this is the consistent tactic that quote unquote pro-life conservative Catholics take every time the party of Trump wants to do some inhuman thing, is they use the unborn as human shields and say, I'm going to pretend to care about abortion, but what I really care about is defending the deportation of innocent people by the hundreds of thousands. And that's what that article was written to do. It was not written to defend the unborn. It was written to defend mass deportation of innocents, which, by the way, Veritatis Splendor says is as much a grave and intrinsic evil as abortion or euthanasia or anything else.
And John Paul II listed on his list of grave evils as well within the encyclical on human dignity.
Evangelium Vitae.
Yeah, the gospel of life. And you know what's weird though, Mark, is this is another sign of the times, which to me are just unique. You know, I mean, I used to think sometimes that we just talk, you know, Catholics, we talk about the same stuff over and over, but I can't use church documents anymore in my arguments with fellow Catholic brothers and sisters.
A lot of times that's true.
No, it's completely new to me. I mean, this is to me within the last like 9-10 months. But you know, our Catholic brothers and sisters no longer share the American church no longer shares a sense of fidelity to the magisterium across its documents.
Well, the way it works, I saw this in Arguments Over Torture 10 years ago. The way it works is always this: what you do is you ask, is this, whatever teaching of the church that I want to ignore, is this infallible and dogmatic?
Sure.
Or is it not that? If it's not that, which is basically virtually everything the church has to say, is not infallible and dogmatic, well, then it's a prudential judgment. And prudential judgment is ecclesiales for, feel free to just blow this off and do whatever you want.
Right.
And that means almost the entirety of the church's moral teaching, is dismissible by the people who call themselves, you know, the real Catholics and the ones who are ready to kick the rest of us out, you know.
Yeah, and look, I mean, you're talking to a graduate of Franciscan University of Steubenville here. I'm not exactly, you know, a conspiring, you know, Georgetown, you know, liberal Catholic, whatever. Like, I believe these people for most of my life that what they're saying was true. Mm-hmm. Whenever Clinton was, whenever it didn't matter what the economy looked like during the Clinton administration, because he was morally corrupt and this was unacceptable for a statesman, and the moral, you know,
right,
majority rose up against that and stuff. Like, I believed, and to some extent, frankly, still believe in that idea,
right,
of character matters and all that stuff. And so,
yeah, so do I.
It was inconceivable to me that someone who no one defends at this point anymore with respect to character, like Trump, could get elected. And it was inconceivable to me in the same sense that at the time, you know, it was the middle of the papacy of John Paul II. It was about understanding Vatican II in terms of its, you know, hermeneutic of continuity and all these things. And the idea was that, like, we're not going to be cafeteria Catholics like the left. We're going to take everything. We're going to read everything. We're going to struggle with things, sure, but we're going to take it all in prayer and this and that. And so I never would have realized that, you know, standing now today, that we can't talk about that because some people have a problem with Francis or have a problem with, you know, this group or that group and stuff. Yeah. And so we're living now in an age where if you would have talked to Sam Rocha in the 1990s or the undergraduate at Franciscan and said, do you ever think there will be a day where a Bill Clinton-like lacking of character in the presidency will receive more defenses than the Pope?
I know.
I would have said, you're crazy.
That, of course. Of course. I'm exactly the same way.
Go jump in the Ohio River.
Yes,
you know?
Of course. And I would have done the same thing.
There's but Mark, here we are.
Here we are, you know? Yeah. And there's a – oh, and I'm blanking on his name now. Dang it. Baptist Muckety-Muck.
Falwell?
No, not Falwell. Oh, dang it. Well, it'll come to me. But, at any rate, he won some kind of honorific from, First Things, and he gave a speech, the title of the speech was something to the effect of, Can the Religious Right Survive? And
he
made the argument, which I have never forgotten, and he's dead right. He says the religious right are the people that the religious right warned you about 20 years ago. And that is exactly true. Religious right has completely embraced the postmodern dictatorship of relativism that they condemned in Bill Clinton 20 years ago.
Right.
And are now, you know, what are they doing? They are calling, you know, a sex predator, a confessed sex predator who mocks the disabled, makes fun of POWs, spits in the face of Gold Star families. that guy is the new Constantine. And everything has been thrown in the basket of he's going to magic away abortion. That's what's going to happen. It's all going to happen. Magically, Roe v. Wade is going to be overturned because Neil Gorsuch is on the court now. Neil Gorsuch, who says that Roe is settled law. And that's all going to happen magically. And because of that, everything else is excused. The opposition to abortion now takes away the sin of the world. And it really is a kind of new soteriology that is radically divorced now from anything resembling a Christian soteriology.
Oh, sure. Well, that gets back to the idea of, like, the loss of the kingdom of God, you know? I mean, it's really total, and it's toxic at a depth that I haven't seen before, and insofar as it colors everything, it's all consuming. There's nothing that it doesn't quite explain. I think actually that without it, we could actually, have a much more interesting conversation where there still might be disagreements, right?
Well, of course, yeah.
Where there still might be, you know, some, but the disagreements would be serious. In this case, it doesn't seem like that. And I just want to remind people that there's actual real people out there.
Yeah.
Who suffer alone, or whose suffering is amplified.
Yeah.
Or who just plain out suffer in ways they wouldn't have suffered otherwise.
Yeah. You mentioned something earlier that I think is important, and I want to tie this into your book.
Sure.
You talked about the fact that there needs to be consolation for people who are struggling in the midst of this. And not just people who are struggling with, you know, the rescinding of DACA, but I mean, people are struggling all over the place. You know, I certainly am, and lots of other people are. And something that, you know, became clear to me when I was first entering the church was you can't build a life just on protest.
That
people need food.
Yes.
And so you've written a book.
Yeah.
Called Tell Them Something Beautiful. Talk about that book a little bit.
Well, the concept, the book is in concrete form. It's a collection of online essays and blog posts and some lectures that I've given between basically during, by the way, it's some people like Rod Dreher took a real stab at this, but it just so happens that it happened in the eight-year term of Obama. It doesn't actually mean I care much for Obama, and I don't. I never voted for him, but it happened, you know, between 2008 and 2016. Mm-hmm. And so, the book, though, instead of organizing it chronologically as like an archive or an anthology, I organized it thematically, finding a theme that seemed to appear a lot over those years, and I added some more content around it. And the idea is basically that, you know, telling the truth is, in one sense of the truth, very easy. I can stand on a box and I can scream 1 + 1 = 2 until I'm hoarse.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling the truth, because 1 + 1 = 2. But there's clearly something impoverished and something wrong with this sense that all there is to sharing the gospel or communicating or arguing or whatever is to tell the truth. And so the book itself is in some sense the performance of an argument that says that if I'm inattentive to beauty, even my truth in its ugliness becomes a lie.
Hmm.
And so the argument is essentially that if we want to know what we should share or what we should say or what we should tell them as teachers or as parents or as friends or whatever it is, we need to tell them something that is ultimately faithful, not only to truth, but in particular to beauty. And so the idea that we tell them something beautiful, unlike Dostoevsky and Greg Wolf and other people, I don't think beauty will save the world. I have a more tragic probably sense than this. But to me, it's still worthwhile all the same, because for me, salvation doesn't necessarily come from the beautiful itself, mm-hmm. but it does allow us to see the source of salvation, which mm-hmm. is Christ. And I think Christ shows us, he shows himself through his wounds, even after the resurrection. He doesn't lose his wounds. He witnesses to us in those wounds to Thomas. He witnesses us to those wounds in the stigmata of St. Francis. He is not afraid to not only be a man, but also be a wounded, resurrected God.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, and by the way, I wasn't dualizing between the human and divine nature there. It was just a matter of speech. I don't want to accidentally talk my way into heresy.
I'm capturing all this audio for your bishop.
Yeah, thank you. I do have a mandatum at stake here. So,
super important to just, you know, scrutinize you at all times.
Thank you. So the book is essentially talking about things that matter to me. So theology, philosophy, teaching, and this idea of deschooling that I am interested in, and the idea of kind of a pre or post or anti-institutional understanding of both the teacher and of education, and a particular way of talking about this big giant word called phenomenology, which just means the study of appearances. And in particular, the appearances of everyday life and the appearances within our kind of folk life. And a part of that folk life for me is, of course, the question of identity, the questions of Mexican-American identity, mm-hmm. the recollections of my ancestors, my grandparents, my uncles, my aunts. So in a weird way, the book, I think, speaks in a different register, not so much a reactionary register, but maybe in a register that would help someone understand the necessary and sufficient conditions for which someone could have the kind of interaction that I've been blessed to have with our dreamer brothers and sisters out there who are scared right now.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, I think that that's the real key. When we can enter into relationship with the actual people who are at any time at threat of any kind of harm, whether it's with the African American community or with the Latino community or with the refugee communities coming from the Middle East or from anywhere else in the world, whoever those people be at the time, the poor in Appalachia, the kind of just desperately poor, you know, white folks, you know, across that area of our country, and
yeah.
any people who is truly oppressed, to be able to meet them isn't going to require primarily, like you said earlier, the truth value of the law or the rules or the correctness of this or that, whether it's political correctness or anything. It's going to require beauty, and I think that beauty is ultimately shared through an act of love.
Yeah.
So that's what the book's about. It's about trying to share that vision in kind of all the breadth of my experience and edited out of a very real snapshot of 8 years of a kind of roller coaster ride we went through in the United States during that period.
Yeah. And are, alas, still going through.
Yeah.
More than ever, I think, right now. Well, I want to thank you, Sam Rocha. Your book is called Tell Them Something Beautiful. You can find it at Amazon, right?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Okay. And you can also find Sam's album. What's the name of your album again?
The Augustan album is called Late to Love. Okay. Late to Love. And people can find links to everything at just samrocha.com. It's all there.
All right. Check it out. I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Sam. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we will be back next week with yet another fascinating interview. See you then. Bye-bye.